This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, and thank you for joining me this Wednesday afternoon. I am Kate Forrester. Coming up before the 12:30 headlines today, I'm going to bring you an update from Australia's biggest sheep station, Rawlinna, which is about 400 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie-Boulder. And you're going to hear from the new owners, the Consolidated Pastoral Company, and their chief executive, Troy Setter, on how things have been tracking over the past few months since they've fully taken the reins. And then a little later in the hour, it is mango season, which is the best time of the year, if you ask me. So I'll check in with how growers are faring across those key growing regions and how many mangoes are we able to get our hands on this year. That's all coming up in the next hour. It is 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. Because today is actually a bit of a special edition of the program, because this year we're celebrating 80 years on air, which actually makes us Australia's longest running radio program. In just a moment, I'm going to hand over to Warwick Long from the Victorian Country Hour. He presents the program, and Kaylee Buchanan from the Queensland Country Hour, who are actually in Canberra today, broadcasting out of Parliament House. Now, they're going to take you through the history and the origins of the program and celebrate what the Country Hour has meant to people right across Australia for eight decades now, which, it's fair to say, is a lot older than me. So anyway, enjoy this special. I will be back with you straight afterwards.
The Country Hour. Celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Yeah, my name's Nobby McMahon. I come from Bensdale. I'm involved in the cattle industry. I take delivery of all the cattle that come into the yards at Bensdale and all the cattle that go out after they're sold.
Nobby, do you listen to the Country Hour?
Yes, I do religiously every day. Just love it because it tells all the country people what's happening around in the in the farming fraternity, you know, where the rain is and all the market reports. It's a great hour. Happy birthday to the Country Hour.
Hip, hip, hooray!
Hip, hip, hooray!
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Yes, we are Australia's longest-running radio program, and we're coming to you from Parliament House today. Warwick Long, I'm the host of the Victorian Country Hour. With you as well is Kaylee Buchanan from the Queensland Country Hour, as we launch the 80th birthday celebrations for the Country Hour today from the studios at Parliament House. We've got a great lineup of people going, but we've also got a lot of history behind us, don't we, Kaylee Buchanan?
We very much do, Warwick. You don't get to 80 years without having a few stories to tell, even the ones that we maybe don't talk about so much on the radio. But it's, you know, we're a week out from the 3rd of December, which was the date of the very first Country Hour in 1945. And I've actually found through all the work we've done this year, reflecting on the contribution of the Country Hour, the original newspaper article that announced that the Country Hour was going to be brought into existence. And it says, Monday, December 3 has been fixed by the ABC as the opening date of its regular Country Hour. It was a national program back then, similar to what we're doing today for a little bit. And it was essentially, the idea behind it was to give a complete service to rural listeners. It was to present, in the words of the ABC's Director of Rural Broadcasts at the time, John Douglas, to present the countrymen's problems in such a way as to create a more sympathetic understanding between the city and the country. And that's still our mission today.
I was about to say, that still exists today. So we're going to talk about that. Remembering back to Dick Snedden, the first Country Hour host 80 years ago, and a livestock auctioneer from Scone who became a broadcaster, right up to today where there is a Country Hour in every state of Australia and in the Northern Territory as well, trying to do exactly what you said. What does it present the countryman's problems?
For a sympathetic ear in the city.
Kaylee Buchanan, Warwick Long in studio with us as well. We have the Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, who's just been called away by the bells of Parliament House, which is something that can happen here. But someone who's a leader of the Federal Nationals, probably doesn't need to get called away because he'd be the one to get himself in trouble, is David Littleproud, the leader of the Nationals, who can join us here, the Shadow Agriculture Minister in this country too. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy birthday.
What's your connection to the Country Hour?
Oh, look, I remember as a small boy growing up at Chinchilla, whether we're out in the paddock, we'd have it on in the ute, or we'd be home having lunch. It was always on the radio. ABC Radio was always on for the Country Hour. To hear about what happened at Roma or Dalby sale yards and the prices that ensured that day. So it was always part of our psyche, and I think it's testament that it's lasted 80 years, and I suspect it'll last another 80. It is a source of truth, and it's a connection to many farmers, to what's happening out there, and also the innovation that happens. And I think it's not just about just that information and commodities. I think the way that our journalists are now looking for that innovation in agriculture and the ideas and the new technology and how it's embraced, I think it's so important.
And, you know, we think about the Country Hours, it started out as a national program, but we now are in every state. And I think about, you know, the difference between my state and Warwick's. You know, Queensland, so decentralised, huge you know, distances to cover. Like, your electorate alone would probably swallow half of Victoria.
Three times the size of Victoria.
I'm not great on geography.
Yeah, that's all right.
So as you went from, you know, the farm kid in Chinchilla to being the leader of the Nationals, how has listening to Country Hours across the nation informed your understanding of, you know, you were an agriculture minister, you had to get up to speed on industries that you didn't necessarily grow up knowing?
Well, it's a pulse. You get the pulse of what's happening in agriculture and what matters to people out there. So it's informative for me, whether before I was in politics, in my professional life as a rural banker sitting around the kitchen table lending money to farmers, but as the agriculture minister, in getting that pulse of Australian agriculture and regional Australia in particular. And because we are, as you say, so decentralised and every state is so unique, and I think that's an important role that it's played as well, is the authenticity between each state, because, you know, in Queensland, our production systems are so much different to those in the south. And that's why I love going into other states and seeing the production systems so different to what I grew up with. But it's that importance, but at a local state level, for there to be an understanding of what happens at our... And that's why I think the ABC's done a good job in making sure there are state bulletins, because it keeps to that local theme.
And just on that too, the idea of regional journalism, whether it be rural and agriculture specific and industry specific, like we're doing here with the Country Hour, but just in general, having a rural voice from the national broadcaster, to your mind, how important is that?
Well, it's even more important now. I mean, we've seen our rural newspapers go. We had Rupert Murdoch come in and buy them all and shut them down. We need to be able to have those journalists on the ground. I think that's a great investment, not just for us, but for those journalists that actually come to Canberra, because coming from Western Queensland, let me tell you, I don't see a lot of common sense in some of the gallery sometimes, and having them schooled in regional Australia about how real Australians actually live and the real essence of what it is to be Australian and what our country is built off, which is rural and regional Australia, to give them that experience before they get to the gallery, I think makes them better journos.
And just before we let you go, really quickly, if we can, because we are tight on time, but there's idea of the Country Hour breaching the city-country divide, is it still there? Is it getting bigger or smaller, that divide?
Well, in fact, I've made it clear to your chairman, Kim Williams, I think it's important that our stories get into state bulletins every week. I think now we've got our journalists right across regional Queensland, regional New South Wales, every state. I think it's important we can bridge that divide through the ABC and our national broadcaster, whether it be TV or radio. I think we should have, whether it be a quota or something, we should have a yarn from regional Australia in those bulletins, and I think that'll be the big role that ABC can play in educating people about how we do it out in the bush and how we produce their food and fibre, and I think that'd be a big role for the ABC to play.
Thanks for joining us on our birthday.
Happy birthday.
Hello there. My name's Norm Hedditch from Taruna Proprietary Limited, and we're Spanish mackerel fishermen in the Northern Territory, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
You're listening to the Country Hour live from Parliament House in Canberra. Callie Buchanan and Warwick Long with you. And we've got one of our guests back, Kelly.
Yes, and in typical Canberra fashion, we had to pivot, get agile. And Julie Collins, the Minister for Agriculture, you've made it back from your division.
I have indeed. I'm glad I turned up, though. The Prime Minister was there, so it wouldn't have been good if I hadn't turned up. But he sends a big happy birthday to Country Hour too.
Thanks very much for joining us on our birthday. What's it been like for you, and what's your relationship been like with the Country Hour?
Well, I have a lot of memories of the Country Hour, you know, and some of the long drives around Tassie, you know, tuning in, listening to the news of, you know, regional Australia. And Tassie, of course, as a whole island, is considered regional Australia. So, you know, we're pretty in tune with what's going on, and the issues that you raise are very relevant to Tasmanians.
Coming from the perspective of, you know, Tassie as a state, being able to speak to the mainland about your issues, how much of has the radio show and the ABC's role played that part for you?
Well, there's no doubt that we need to tell stories, as we've just heard, of regional Australia right around the country, so that we get that divide between the regions and the cities, so that, you know, people that live in cities understand the country, understand the regions of Australia, where a lot of the country's wealth comes from, let's face it, but also important things like their food, and more even their energy is coming from regional Australia. So, you know, some of life's essentials are coming from the regional parts of the country, so it's really important that we have that connection. And I think, you know, that investment in regional Australia, you know, and having the journalists all around the regions across the country is so important. And it's important to be able to tell those stories and to tell them authentically. And it's those networks on the ground, I think, that those journalists have that give us that authenticity of the stories of what's really going on. I mean, you can hear about it, you know, in people living in the three big cities across the country, the three majors. But to actually go out and experience it, you really need to have the network. You really need to have that on the ground journalism. And it really matters today, I think, so that we can continue to tell those stories so that all Australians understand exactly what's going on in all parts of the country.
And we've spoken about bridging a city-country divide, the original idea of this program 80 years ago. How do you think that divide's going? As a minister, you're trying to bridge it into the world of federal politics as well. Do you see that as a wide divide, or is it getting smaller?
I think it's getting smaller, and I think Australians are really proud of what our country produces and what we've achieved as a nation. And I think that that comes, you know, whether you're in the city folk or the regional folk, you know, we should be incredibly proud of Australia and some of the things that we've been able to achieve as a nation. You know, here we are 80 years later, and we're one of the wealthiest nations on the planet, and that didn't happen by accident. It's due to the hard work of so many right across our country, including those regions where a lot of the wealth comes from.
And feeding 80 million people a year.
Absolutely. You know, in agriculture, you know, net exporter, $100 billion agriculture, fisheries, forestry. It's enormous. And the fact that, 80% by value goes overseas, we are feeding the globe.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for coming in and fitting us in around all those votes.
I'm sorry about the coming and the going. And I know you've got a lot of other guests lined up, but
we made
very sincere happy birthday to Country Hour, and long may it continue.
Great to have you. Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins there, also representing the Tasmanians on this show today, which has been great. Let's bring in a fellow Queenslander of yours now, Kelly Buchanan.
We might have stacked the deck a little bit here, but the reason for bringing in Hamish is, of course, he is the newly elected president of the NFL. Hamish McIntyre, welcome to the Country Hour. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You're here for, you've got your own board meeting today as
Correct.
Well, but tell us about your relationship with the Country Hour.
Look, it goes a long way back. As a young person growing up in Western Queensland, north of St George, I mean, I always remember the Country Hour coming on, and as children being told to quieten down so we could hear the news. And obviously the weather too was always a huge part of it. So, look, sincerely, a very, you know, happy 80th birthday to the Country Hour, and you've been a huge part of many people's lives, a massive number of people over the years in regional Australia, and provide a very important service to us in times of difficulty too. It's so great having that connection and hearing from the ABC about what's going on where, and what we can do, and if a situation arises.
The NFF is very much about bringing farming issues to Canberra and trying to get an outcome for industry, right? That's largely what it was built around. How important then is the Country Hour to the NFF to get issues and discussion around issues that are important to you back out to the regions that you serve?
very important, and we really value that connection and how the ABC particularly, you know, does provide that service so that our people here in Canberra have the opportunities, and myself as president and all the previous presidents, that we can articulate where we're up to with, you know, issues of the day and their relevance to Australia and the way we the role we play in producing food and fibre for not just Australians but for our regional community, which is so important.
We get quite a bit of feedback on the ABC and the Country Hour about the show. When you're on the program, do you get a bit of stick from the blokes back home?
Yes, you can do, depending on, the what's being discussed at time. But it's look, it is so important that we do have that connectivity. And as Minister Collins just said, I mean, linking the city to regional Australia is so important. We have that very important connection, as we say. I mean, everyone, no matter where you are in Australia, need a farm, you know, three times a day. And, you know, we wake up in the morning usually between cotton sheets too, our natural fibres. So we are linked despite the disconnect that we do hear about. We are we do rely on each other, and it's so important that we have be able to get the stories out that really affect all of us, no matter whether you're in a regional city or in regional Australia.
It's been so great to get you to come here, jammed in between a couple of meetings for yourself. So thanks so much for celebrating some of our birthday with us.
Great, thank you. And I really do mean it. You know, all the best, and we look forward to the future, and happy birthday.
Hamish McIntyre,
see you in a paddock somewhere.
The NFF president speaking to you there. His operation is fascinating. We'll talk about that more in the future. Kelly, just in the last 30 seconds or so, it's interesting that so much of the discussion around our birthday is that bridge of the city-country divide. There are fewer farmers than ever before in Australia right now, but a lot of people working in agriculture, and that need to talk about how food is produced and how the experiences of the people producing it is still as relevant today as it was 80 years ago.
It absolutely is, and we have this unique opportunity in our role to do that directly to the mainstream, you know, city audiences. We can reach them. So all you need to do is open up your ABC Listen app and you can be listening to the Country Hour, whether it's here or on a trail in Morocco, apparently. So, yeah, we do our best to keep that philosophy going.
We're online, we're on air. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll hand you back now to your local Country Hour.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
Thanks, Warwick, and thank you, Kelly. And I agree. I remember growing up as a little kid in the farm ewe as Dad fed sheep, listening to the Country Hour on the radio. And I'm feeling very honoured at the moment to be able to present the very program I listened to all those years ago and celebrate 80 years of the Country Hour. And on that topic that they kept mentioning about the city-country divide, I am keen to get your thoughts today. Do you think that divide is actually getting wider? I've always thought that we should broadcast our program into Perth because it's going to help that disconnection. But let me know your thoughts on the text line 0448 922 604 22 past 12. Now, Richard Hudson is with me in the studio because a national livestock export conference kicked off in Perth this morning. Richard, I hear the focus was on sheep. Is that right?
Yeah, it was for today. So this is LiveX Change 25 is the catchy title. A few hundred delegates, and the session I've just come from focused on looking back at the last 50 years of the Western Australian Livestock Exporters Association. And it was pretty interesting hearing some of the history and the importance of the industry to Western Australia and the rest of Australia. But the conference was kicked off by LiveCorp Chairman Troy Setter, who wears another hat as well, because he's the Chief Executive of Consolidated Pastoral Company. That's the new owner of Australia's biggest sheep property, Rulina Station, which is located out on the Nullarbor, about 400 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie Boulder. I had a chat with him after he opened proceedings and after most of the discussions this morning, because I was keen to get an update on their restocking plans.
Yeah, the sale went through about 2 months ago. It took about 6 weeks to get through FIRB and then a bit over 6 months to get through the Western Australian Government approval process. And now we're getting on with redeveloping and getting the station back to its former glory.
Have you been buying in some sheep in the last couple of months then?
Yeah, in the last couple of months we've been able to put together about 4,500 merino ewes, all from Western Australia, and getting those settled down on the property.
So how many do you have now?
We've got about 35,000 sheep. We plan to get the property back up to 60,000 to 70,000 sheep over the next couple of years.
So where do you think you're going to be accessing the remaining sheep that you need?
out of Western Australia, as well as breeding our own. So we plan to keep 100% of the lambs that were marked this year, and we'll keep the next year's lambs as well. We'll grow a bit of a weather flock there just to help in the first couple of years to get the numbers up. And external sheep will come from WA.
You bought the property off Jumbuck, who were obviously Adelaide-based, and because they were Adelaide-based, they probably had some pretty strong ties to South Australia. Do you think, as it's going to be run in future, it'll maybe have stronger ties to WA?
Yeah, I think so. We've been quite clear that we, as much as we can commercially, but operationally, run it as a Western Australian property. The rams for this year were already part of the contract to come across from the east, but we've said to plenty of Western Australian studs that we'd really like to see what we could do with them going forward into the future years.
Now let's take a look at the infrastructure, because only about 18 months ago there were some pretty severe floods went through that area just near the Nullarbor, and Rawlinna was certainly affected. How's, first of all, the fencing going?
The fencing's is pretty good. There's still some work to do, and we've been advertising for some new staff and got some new team members joining us, which is great, so we can get into fixing the fencing and the waters up for the sheep. And there's a really big job on the buildings as well.
Does the advert say, do you like open spaces?
Absolutely. It's the largest sheep station in the world and arguably one of the most remote. But that's a real appeal for people, and it's a really tight community with the team that's there. We want to make sure that we've not only got an adventure there for people, but also a nice place to live.
How's the property looking now, your understanding? Because the last winter was actually pretty kind to that part of WA, wasn't it?
Yeah, the property's looking really good. I've been out there a couple of times in the last few months, and we've been getting good rain for the Nullarbor, some 15 to 20 mil falls, and that's great. So the feed looks really good, and the sheep are in great condition.
Now, we're here for the LiveX conference, a national conference, and this morning, most of today, it's going to be concentrating on the sheep side of things. You're the LiveCorp chairman, and you kick proceedings off today. Wearing that hat, but still wearing your Rawlinna hat, how important is the live sheep trade and industry to Rawlinna?
The live sheep trade is really important to Rawlinna. Even if our sheep don't go on a ship, the underpinning price and the competition from the live sheep trade is crucial. It also gives us critical mass for access to shearers and vets, wool handling, trucks. So the live sheep trade is very, very important, and there will be certainly some challenges with the adjustment.
It was interesting just hearing some of the history, wasn't it? One of the former chairs of the Western Australian Livestock Exporters Association was just saying the earliest exports dated back to the early 1900s. Small quantities, but I actually didn't realise it went back that far.
Yeah, the live export of sheep and cattle and horses out of Western Australia to all around the world is over 100 years, and it's certainly been very, very important for establishing rural and regional Western Australia and Australia.
A couple of the speakers this morning, one was Western Australia's Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis saying, I suppose re-emphasising the point that she personally supports the live sheep trade, and that's at odds with what Labor's doing. In your mind, did she say anything else that grabbed your attention?
I think there was certainly a commitment from her to invest further in the cattle trade, particularly in Northern Australia for live export, and a real recognition of the challenges for the sheep industry with not as much market demand, but also I think she was a bit of a realist of there's not a lot she can do as a state minister. It really sits with the federal government.
Now, one thing that grabbed my attention this morning was Andrew Robb. So he was the Federal Trade Minister from 2013 to 2016. He also used to work with the NFF and the Cattle Council, as you know. What I did find interesting was just how emotionally got when he was referring back to that live cattle ban from 2011.
Yeah, Andrew's been involved with the live cattle trade as a trade minister, but also as NFF and Cattle Council CEO, and things that he's seen it firsthand. I think Andrew has seen the challenges that are ongoing. It wasn't just the 2011 period, but when Andrew became Trade Minister a couple of years later, he had to go and negotiate with Indonesia to free up permits. The AICEPA, the trade agreement negotiations, effectively got put on pretty thick ice during that time, and he and then subsequent ministers renegotiated that. Andrew knows of people who've died of old age, people who've died of suicide and taken their lives due to financial stress, the divorces, the absolute strain that's been on people since 2011 and remains today. And you could see that the passion, frustration, and care in his voice as he did his presentation.
So what you're referring to there is the fact that the class action has taken 11 years and it's still ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is still ongoing and hurting the relationship with Indonesia that it's not resolved. I appreciate it's going through a court process, but there's a much simpler and more cost effective way, not only for the producers and the exporters, but the Australian taxpayer as well, to resolve this quickly, and we all hope that can be done.
Another thing that he mentioned caught my attention too, and that was saying he believes he's most proud of the live export industry for shaping positive views of Australia in countries such as Kuwait or Indonesia. And when he finished, he said, make sure you're proud of the industry and defend it. He was very strong on defend it, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think all agricultural industries, particularly live export, no, none of us have a right to exist. We absolutely need to share positively and passionately our good stories, and if we have issues, we need to, you know, be upfront about them and fix them. When I travel through Southeast Asia, we've got a large business in Indonesia around cattle importing, and I spend time in the Middle East. The Australian livestock are known as being world leaders, not only for disease, freedom and health status, but just the high quality, whether it's high quality of wool, milk or meat, and structural soundness, and the positive impact we have on communities. And we often don't share that with people, and we absolutely need to share it and positively promote and defend our industry.
Well, I better let you get back inside the conference, but thanks very much for your time on the WA Country Hour.
Thank you, Richard. It's always great to be on the WA Country Hour. Thank you.
Troy Setter is the CEO and director of the Consolidated Pastoral Company.
It's a fascinating company as well, owned by the Hands family, who are based in Britain. And CPC is actually the largest privately owned cattle producer in Australia and also the largest exporter of cattle into Indonesia. They're involved in cropping as well. And as you just heard, they're now getting back into the sheep industry in quite a big way. Just quickly, Kate, in some live export news, it's just been announced Chris Back is the new independent chair of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. You might remember Dr. Back is a vet and former WA senator.
Thanks, Richard, for that update. I'll see you back in here in just a short moment for the rainfall. It is 28-1 here on the Country Hour. And Jonathan Bill, you're in the studio now.
Indeed, in the headlines, Kate, an assault charge against a Kalgoorlie man accused of cutting off his father's arm with a samurai sword has been dropped. Jackson Jai Trinidad allegedly severed James Naibo's arm in February. In the Kalgoorlie District Court today, prosecutors discontinued a charge of aggravated grievous bodily harm on the grounds there is no reasonable prospect of a conviction. The court was told the state cannot negate a home invader defence or self-defence. A 28-year-old woman who allegedly murdered a baby in Perth's south is to undergo mental health assessments. Alana Gail Smithwick was charged after the 8-month-old was found dead at a property in Baldivis in October. A Perth court has been told a forensic psychiatrist has been engaged by the defence. The prosecution is seeking its own report regarding Ms. Smithwick's fitness to plead. And the Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says the latest official monthly inflation figures are higher than the government would like. Bureau of Statistics figures show annual headline inflation rose to 3.8% in October, up from 3.6% in the year to September. Economists believe the October result makes a December interest rate cut increasingly unlikely. More news, Kate, at 1.
The Country Hour with Kate Forrester on ABC Radio WA.
It is 27 away from one. And just a little earlier, we were talking about Country Hour turning 80. And we went over to Canberra to hear from Warwick Long and Callie Buchanan from the Country Hour over East. And I did put the question to you asking if you think that the city-country divide is either growing, is it shrinking, and what does the Country Hour do to fix that gap? And on the text line, TG says, of course the divide is growing for varying reasons. As far as reaching the young ones, you'd have to go to FM. Even then, I don't think they would listen. It doesn't fit their agendas. Thanks so much, TG. And then also Sandy from Karratha says, I totally agree with you, Kate. We need city folk to be aware of what's happening outside of their bubble. And that's just referring to the Country Hour going live to Perth, not just the country. Anyway, it's now time to check in on the weather with the Bureau of Meteorology. Joey Rawson joins me. Joey, let's start in the south of the state this afternoon. Can you tell me what's happening?
Yeah, no problems. We have a kind of a weak front that's crossing the southwest of the state at the moment. It's dropping a little bit of rain through kind of the southwest district, like 4 or 5 millimetres at tops, but as it pushes inland, we're seeing less rainfall, and that will weaken out a fair bit because there isn't that much to that front. As we progress on to tomorrow, we have another kind of weakish front that's just going to brush the south coast, so we're expecting showers to kind of persist along the south coast. Those showers won't penetrate into the Great Southern, so then we have some kind of leftover showers on Friday, and then once we get to Saturday and Sunday, things really clear up. So once this weak front moves through, it's looking like a pretty good window to get some of that harvesting done, Kate, and things do warm up as well. Once we get to Monday, we start seeing some, you know, quite warm to hot temperatures pushing down from the north. So starting to go back into that summer pattern for the south, Kate.
Oh, my gosh. I'm hanging out for it. So I don't know how the farmers are feeling. Look, Joey, what about if we move now to the north of the state? How are they tracking up there?
Yeah, so not too bad. We still have a lot of cloud from Tropical Cyclone Fina or ex-Tropical Cyclone. But there's not a lot of shower activity and thunderstorm activity in WA. There's some nice bands moving into Northern Territory. I can't rule out a thunderstorm developing in the afternoon and dropping a fair bit of rain, but at this stage things are looking relatively good through that kind of Kununurra, Wyndham area. That activity will move and weaken to the east over the next couple of days, but we're just left with thunderstorms and showers through the Kimberley and interior for today and tomorrow. The showers and thunderstorms will extend from the Kimberley and interior into the Pilbara for Friday, and then just keep extending a little bit further to the west on a Saturday and Sunday. And, yeah, we're expecting those showers and thunderstorms to maybe reach as far west as Shark Bay or, you know, nearly getting to Cowberry. So, yeah, it's really kind of a summer shower thunderstorm trough type pattern.
Thanks, Joey. Joey Rawson there from the Bureau, and Richard Hudson making his way back into the studio to give us the update on rainfall up until 9 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, and as you'd expect, most of the rain was in the Kimberley after that tropical cyclone. Diggers Rest 90 millimetres, Ellenbrae 70, Kununurra's airport recorded 10, and the Deepherd station at Kununurra 18. Parry Creek Farm 74 and Wyndham topped it with 147. And then you've got to go down to the southwest for anywhere else that had above 1 mil. In the southwest itself, there was lots of places had between 1 and 4, and above that there was Brunswick Junction with 5, Newlands had 5 as well, and Rosabrook 6. And then I think nowhere else actually had a single mill. Southern Coastal, Central, yeah, nowhere else there was a single mill.
Well, Richard, before you go, a text came through earlier this morning from Mick in Wyndham, and he says it was a pretty rough night with loud thunder and lightning and some very heavy rainfall too. He texted in to say that they had 197 mills at their place in Wyndham, which, yes, yeah, seems quite a high number for rainfall figures and one of the highest on the Bureau's website. But I am keen to hear from you this afternoon. If you're around that northeast region of the Kimberley, how much did you get at your place? And has this come at a good time for you? Let me know, 0448 922 604. Now, Richard, before you scoot out of the studio, you were away yesterday because you had to attend a funeral.
Yeah, and it was quite an amazing one. It was yesterday afternoon. It was for a guy called John Slee, who was 94, so he had a good innings, didn't quite get his century. He was a Dunsborough local, and he's a dad of a really good mate of mine, and he was renowned for being someone who was very inquisitive. He was a journo, ran his own papers. He ran the Subiaco Post for a while, did everything at home, the printing of it and blah, blah, blah. But right from the moment this service started, there was a strong emphasis on his sense of humour, and it just shone through. Most funeral services, there's a real sense of emotion, and there was that there. But I cried four times during this particular funeral service, but it was from laughing. His three sons spoke, and also one of his granddaughters, and even his wife spoke as well, very bravely. But to give you a sense of not only his humour, but I suppose his character, he was renowned for being a bit of a tight ass, and he did some costings on a coffin, and he came back and he goes, the cheapest one I can find is about $2,000, stuff that, I'm going to make my own. And so he was part of a local men's shed, and he sourced the cheapest wood he could find, got the help of his mates to actually help him build this coffin that is acceptable for funeral parlours and whatnot. And then that's what he was in, and it was painted bright yellow, not because that's actually the paint that he chose. It was all he had left in the shed. And then at the end of
couldn't even go down to the shops to buy some new paint.
Then at the end of the funeral service, they invited everyone to come up and sign it. It was truly unique, but it was so nice to walk out of a funeral not only feeling uplifted, but with a genuine smile on your face. It was really amazing.
Yeah, wow. Thank you for sharing that, Richard. It is 20 to 1 here on the Country Hour, and a Midwest-based octopus fisher, an aquaculture operator, says an inquiry into fisheries management in WA is necessary for the future of recreational and commercial fishing. Anthony Haygarth is the principal petitioner of a Nationals WA petition calling for the inquiry, which he says was brought to politicians by the fishing industry. He says government departments need more consistency in the priorities which underpin their decisions.
Now, look, I've just been concerned for a number of years now that we've seen a shift away from science-based fisheries management to a situation where there's more politics coming into play in the management of fisheries, and that's not necessarily giving us the best outcome for sustainability or for seafood production.
This petition, it was launched by the Nationals at the end of October, but was it the result of people like yourself who don't necessarily catch demersals looking at the situation going, we need to step back here?
Well, certainly the commercial sector for a long time has been questioning the direction that we're heading with the management of a lot of our fisheries and indeed the entire aquatic estate. And I think more and more the rec sector, individuals within the rec sector are becoming more and more vocal about actually having better transparency around the way that our fisheries are managed, you know, how we consider the management of the total aquatic estate in terms of managing our fisheries.
You're mainly in octopus fishing as well as aquaculture. For you, within your industries, what are the big concerns when you think about the management decisions being made and the approaches being taken?
Well, my biggest concern is that we've seen a shift away from science-based fisheries management. And, you know, we've seen that over a number of years. You know, you go back a decade or two, Western Australia were regarded globally as world leaders in science-based fisheries management. And we are no longer held in that esteem. So we are now managing fisheries based on, in my view, on political decisions rather than science. And I don't believe the fisheries department's adequately resourced now to carry out those science-based fisheries management tasks. We don't have enough investment in research, and you can see that in the number of people who have left the department in recent years.
And what about development and support of the aquaculture industry?
Oh, look, both sides of government have supported aquaculture. Whether it's been focused in the right direction, though, is another question. I think governments tend to go for the big headline grabs rather than actually look at what is sustainable, economically viable in the longer term. And we've seen that in the Midwest, where we've had all the talk around the big proposals for fish farms and the like for some of these large eastern states companies, and there's been a lot of fanfare around them, and state government have, you know, offered money, but none of these things have actually got off the ground. Where when you look around locally, we've got a number of small operators that are, you know, battling through red tape to try and develop businesses.
What would be the initial terms of this inquiry? Where would you really like it to dig into initially?
It's two-pronged. You know, we've got to look at food security, particularly with what's happening in the, you know, the Indo-Pacific and up in the South China Sea. We really need to consider our food security long-term. We also need to look at our West Australian lifestyle around recreational fishing and camping. It's the way I was brought up. It's the way I want my, well, the way my children were brought up, and it's what my, I want my grandchildren to enjoy, to be able to go and camp on beaches and catch fish and enjoy the West Australian lifestyle. And I think that's been under threat as well. So that needs to be part of the inquiry as well.
Midwest fisher and aquaculture operator Anthony Haygarth speaking to Joe Prendergast. And Joe did ask the state fisheries minister, Jackie Jarvis, to come on the program to speak on this topic, but she declined. Instead, she sent us this statement. Western Australia's fisheries management is informed by world-class science. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development conducts research and stock assessments across the state's fisheries. The status of stocks are published annually and are publicly available. The minister then goes on to add that we are proud that nine of the state's fisheries currently have independent sustainability certification by the Marine Stewardship Council, demonstrating WA's global leadership in fisheries management, underpinned by world-class science. I've been clear that tough decisions will be made in the coming weeks regarding our demersal fisheries, and I continue to work through the issues and consult with the sector ahead of any announcement. We held a fishing futures forum for all stakeholders in the Legislative Assembly of Parliament last month to engage positively on finding workable solutions to this very serious and urgent issue. We invited the opposition, but instead of working collaboratively, they have instead decided to run a petition. So that's from the Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis. Let me know on the text line your thoughts on what she has to say. 0448 922 604. You can also let me know what Anthony Haygarth and what he had to say, what you thought of that. It is 14 away from one, and while the push for an inquiry highlights the challenges facing today's fishers, some have watched the industry change over a long period of time. Dennis Holt started fishing the waters of the Shark Bay region half a century ago, catching mainly whiting with his nets. Now retired, he says a series of decisions over the years has contributed to the fishing industry shrinking in his region.
When I started fishing, when I left school with my father, there was 26 licensed fishing boats fishing out of here in 65, 66. Over the years, they just dwindled down. People got out of it and did other things. We had our own freezer. Russ Cooper, he was our fish buyer, and he sold most of it to South Australia because they used to be a big whiting producing town in Adelaide or South Australia in general, and their stocks just dwindled to nothing, and because they were all whiting-eating people and they wanted our whiting, so that worked out good for us. But look, some of the effects on the fishing here was the salt works, and at the same year that that started to take place, the prawning industry started in Carnarvon, and when they first started, they could trawl anywhere in Shark Bay within the two estuaries, and which they did, and that's fine. They had a licence to do that, but they trawled everything and anything. And because eventually we got things changed and they got pushed back out of the Gulf, and they realised then the further out of the Gulf they got, the bigger the prawns were. So instead of catching them down here when they were that long, yeah, they got them out deeper water, further out the Gulf where they were bigger. So
yeah. That
all settled itself down. But now the boys tell me that there's not a lot of fish out there. I don't know why. They always made the comment to me, they said, there's none out there because you caught them all before you retired. That's a bit of a joke. But, yeah, look, I don't know. We had the heat wave in 2011, killing a lot of the seagrass, whether that effect on it, I don't know. But, yeah, I think it's a dying art at the moment. The fishing in Shark Bay, I don't think it'll be around much longer. There's only two or three people that are still fishing. So.
And dying because the fish just aren't there to sustain a business?
That's how it will finish up. The boys tell me, well, I've been retired over 10 years now, but the boys tell me that there's not a... They said the fish aren't out there now like they used to be when you were fishing. And I have a bit of a dig at them and say, oh, you both got no competition. That's all wrong with you. But, but maybe it's true that there's not a lot of stocks out there. I don't know what the answer is to that. But
you feel like maybe it's linked to that heat wave?
That could have upset the apple cart. And, I mean, the fishing's been going since, well, apparently they caught a bit of fish here before the war, the Second World War. Not a lot, but after the war that was sort of full on. So, you know, it's been going for, what, nearly 80-odd years. So something's got to let go. We've had a lot of rules and regulations over that period of time, obviously. You know, we adjusted our net sizes and all sorts to let the smaller fish go. So, and on top of all that is the tourist industry, and I'm not against tourism, but the tourist industry, well, I was down on the foreshore last year. There was 179 boat trailers.
In one day?
That's just in Denham. Then you got Monkey Mia, you got Nanga, Steep Point, Dugardug Island. And look, everyone's got the right to catch a fish, but there needs to be more regulations against it.
Would they be catching the same fish that you were targeting?
Some of them are. The snapper, we used to catch snapper. But, I mean, now a lot of the boats are a bit bigger and better and they go outside the Gulf, which helps the fish stocks within the Gulf, because the fisheries have told us that the fish stocks within the Gulf are a different species to the ones outside. They look the same to me, but that's what they tell us. So. But, yeah, I think they need to regulate it a bit better. I don't know what the answer is, but if they don't, they mightn't have a tourist industry either, because there's not going to be any fish. So you've got to look after what you have got the best way you can.
Retired Shark Bay fisher Dennis Holt speaking to Joe Prendergast, and he spent about 45 years on the water in the Shark Bay region. 10 to 1. Well, mango season is well and truly underway in northern WA, and in Kununurra, harvest is almost finished for the season. Australian Mango CEO Trevor Dunmull says, unfortunately, it looks like it hasn't been the best year for Kimberley growers.
Our dispatch data and forecasts look like there's only about 60,000 to 80,000 trays this season, which is a little bit lower than we anticipated. Certainly, the region had really good mango flowering, but unfortunately, a lot of those flowers didn't turn into fruit.
Okay, and is that because of some of the seasonal conditions? Like, you know, what would be impacting that?
Yeah, seasonal conditions are certainly have a huge impact on fruit set and fruit development. Every region suffers a little bit of different seasonal conditions, so it's disappointing for the growers, but the joy, unfortunately, of mango growing.
And what about the quality? So there's less fruit around, but what's the quality like coming out of Kununurra at the moment?
It's all, most of it's going down Perth markets. I think, well, I haven't seen any myself, but certainly reports are that it's good quality fruit, and Kununurra has a reputation of producing good quality fruit every year.
And I guess on a national scale, if we talk about mango volumes, how are we tracking this year?
We're tracking well. Darwin and Catherine have had good volumes of fruit. Harvest season's been reasonably spread out, and now North Queensland's commenced picking. So volumes appear to be similar lines to last season. We had 10 million trays nationally, so I think we'll get pretty close to that this year.
Australian Mango CEO Trevor Dunmull speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. And while we're on the topic of Christmas fruit, each year supermarket retailers reject hundreds of thousands of kilos of imperfect cherries for their slightly odd shapes and sizes. So this year, a produce box service that delivers imperfect fruit and vegetables has rescued around 140,000 kilograms of cherries that supermarkets had rejected. Josh Ball is the co-founder of Farmer's Pick and says he was stunned to discover just how many cherries never make it to the supermarket shelves, especially given their very short season.
With cherries, we see thousands, if not millions of kilos wasted every year because of the way they look. And we thought this year, let's go on a mission to save 140,000 kilos of them before they're left out in the field.
And that's just due to minor imperfections?
Yeah, minor imperfections drive cherries being rejected. So sometimes they're too small, they're not red enough, or they're just missing the stem, and that's enough for them to get knocked back from being perfect.
We've been hearing a lot from producers that the weather has been stalling the season as well. So is this 140,000 just what's currently in the supply chain, or what's coming up into Christmas?
For us, this is 140,000 kilos over the whole season coming into Christmas. We have seen a delayed season due to weather. It's been a little bit chilly for the cherries to grow, but they're definitely starting to come on strong over this week, and the next week we'll start to see a big flush probably of supply.
What are some of the most common imperfections you'll see on a cherry? You mentioned that it could just be a stem that's missing.
The size and the shape is usually the biggest problem. One of my favourite ones is when we get double cherries, so you'll get two of them attached to each other, and the taste is very, very rarely impacted. And usually they're just, you know, they're juicy and delicious, just like any other cherry would be. Imperfections are also a big one, but they really have no impact on the flavour.
Were you shocked about how much potential waste there could be in this supply chain, considering we're coming up to the period of the year where cherries are most popular?
Cherries have such a short season. There's only, you know, 6, 8, maybe 10 weeks of the year where cherries are growing, and you know, Aussies absolutely love them coming into Christmas. So to see any of them go to waste is a bit of a shock horror to us.
When you're speaking with farmers, do the supermarkets have any kind of plans to change this and maybe have like imperfect cherries that you could buy at a cheaper price or that you could use in things like stuffing for a turkey for Christmas?
When we talk to cherry farmers, we find that there's very rarely different outlets for them to sell their cherries, which is why we try and position ourselves as, you know, an alternative that can help them move the unwanted stock, even though they taste absolutely delicious.
Farmers Pick's been going for a number of years now. So what kind of overall impact has your organisation had on the food supply chain and waste?
Yeah, Farmers Pick started over 5 years ago when me and a mate saw a bendy carrot at a market and thought, what's going on here? When we discovered that so much food and produce is left out on the farm and goes to waste because of how it looks, not how it tastes, we thought we had to do something. So since we started about 5 years ago, we've saved over 10 million kilos direct from the farm and, yeah, delivered direct to households across Australia.
And if someone is listening that is interested in joining Farmers Pick, what kind of areas of Australia do you service?
Currently, we primarily service the east coast of Australia, including a big showing in regional Australian areas, as well as obviously city and metro regions. We're always looking for new farmers to supply from and try and work in and understand their waste and growing patterns. They can reach out via our website at farmerspick.com.au. Love to hear from you.
Director and co-founder of Farmers Pick, Josh Ball, speaking with Jane McNaughton. And even though Josh mentioned they're mainly servicing the East Coast right now, if you're a grower here in the West, it might be worth reaching out to Josh. It sounds like they're open to expanding if the interest is there. 4 minutes away from 1 o'clock, and it was a large yarding of sheep at Katanning this morning, almost 18,400 sold, so numbers up about 8,000 on last week. Tracy Kilner is with me. Can you run me through all the details, please, Tracy?
The larger yarding did not deter buyers, with all categories gaining with demand. The lamb yarding consisted of good lines of heavy lambs, with the small store and unfinished lambs dominating the numbers. Processors competed strongly on all categories, with restockers picking up the smaller stores. Mutton dominated the yarding, with big lines of heavy ewes on offer, as well as a large yarding of store lines. Processor demand continued to push all mutton categories up between $10 to $40 a head. The new season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from $100 to $180. Heavier lambs made from $170 to $230 a head. Trade weight lambs sold from $200 to $270, while heavyweights made from $230 up to $290 a head. Merino store weather hoggets ranged from $80 to $183. Medium and heavyweights sold from $171 to $241 a head. The Merino ewe hoggets returned from $135 to $174 for lightweight stores, and the medium and heavyweights sold from $160 to $247 a head. Store mutton made from $120 up to $200. Prime medium weight ewes returned $170 to $237, and heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $220 to $265 a head. Mature store weathers made from $170 to $190, while medium and heavyweights returned $190 up to $266 a head. Mature rams sold from $70 to $200 with continued demand from processors. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as much of Queensland swelters through a heatwave, while in the southeast of the state, residents are bracing for severe thunderstorms for the third day in a row. New inflation data out today. How will it factor into the RBA's last rates decision of the year? Why your bank may be poised to task AI with checking your next loan application? And scientists and First Nations staff team up to restore parts of the Great Barrier Reef. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
That coming up after the news at 1 o'clock. We are 1 minute away from that point. And on the text line, a lot of you saying happy birthday to the Country Hour. Tommy and his mini Mac dog sidekick have texted in. They say, happy birthday to the Country Hour. 80 years on air calls for 80 honks from the purple Mac to celebrate. Wherever you are, Tommy, I am really wishing I could hear those honks. Thank you. And Jan from Albany says, hi, Kate. The Country Hour should definitely be aired in Perth. It would help break down the division between the city and the country. Cheers for a great program over the past 80 years. Thank you for your text, Jan. And Chris says, I'm always disappointed when I go to Perth as I can't pick up the Country Hour. And I get really disappointed when you put the cricket on. Thank you, Chris. And just quietly, I get quite disappointed when the cricket's on too. Anyway, I'm not going to give away all my secrets. I will chat to you tomorrow, Thursday afternoon, here on the WA Country Hour. Thank you for celebrating with me this Wednesday. Have a great afternoon. It is 1 o'clock. It is news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.